Hey, this is Alex Terranova, and this is the Dream Mason Podcast. We've been taught to behave, to fit in, to follow the rules, but Dream Masons reject conventional thought. Dream Masons are rebels. They take a chisel to the marble that is typical traditional life. They carve out brilliance and broadcast it to the world. Join me for another chapter as we unmask convention, embrace the rebels within us, and more deeply come to explore the complex and agitated edges of our existence. Now, before we get started, please don't be a rebel yet and grab your phone and hit that little button that says subscribe. Thank you. Because your dreams don't build themselves. What's up and welcome back to the Dream Mason Podcast. I am your host, Alex Terranova. This episode is going to be kind of different and fun. I feel like it's a throwback to, it's like the coming home episode, if I had to give it a kind of a little name. So people that have been listening to this podcast for a long time, you've learned a lot about me over the course of the last 3 years. I share with you my business. I share with you my heartbreaks. I share with you sometimes, you know, my love life. I share with you wins, struggles, personal stories from my childhood. Pretty much anything that seems relevant in the topics that we're talking about. Well, today we're going to, you're going to meet an entrepreneur who has created something that I really like and is growing it, but he's also had some ups and downs and some really cool, you know, I'm really interested to dig into his stories of how he got where he is, but he's here and we tracked him down because he's one of the owners of a coffee shop that I love. And I want to give you a little backstory. So if you're new to this podcast or you're just hearing, or maybe you just haven't listened to all the episodes or paid attention, I grew up in Los Angeles. And I grew up on like the west side of LA. So I lived basically between downtown LA and the beach, like right in between. And as I got older into high school, I went to Santa Monica High School. So Santa Monica High School, if you don't know, is about a block from the ocean. You can see the ocean from like the track and football field. And it's a pretty, at least when I went there, I went to high school in 1996 to 2000. It was a pretty great place to go to high school. It was safe. It was fun. There was, I don't want to say it was like the most diverse, but there was a decent aspect of diversity. There were lots of different kinds of people. And even socioeconomic, there were kids that were very, very wealthy and kids not so much. And being a baseball player, I got to interact with a lot of different kinds of people. That high school set up, I want to say the next, I don't know, 12 years of my life, I ended up going to Gold's Gym in Venice Beach from 18 years old to 30, creating connections and friendships at that place, that iconic gym. I ran restaurants and bars on the west side of LA. I opened some, I expanded some. And I mean, I probably fell in love and got my heart broke a bunch of times throughout restaurants and bars throughout these places. And when I moved to New York when I was 30, there was aspects that I really missed about LA. And whenever I would come back, which was pretty often because my grandparents were old. It was actually my grandmother was in her 90s and we didn't know how long she would be around. So I would come back from New York almost every month just to like see her. But when I would come back, I would always go back into Venice Beach and Santa Monica because that's what felt like home. And I'd visit friends and I'd go to restaurants. And one of the times I came back, one of the first times I came back, there was this coffee shop that had opened and it had this cool logo. It totally had like this surfer skater motif. It's called Dogtown Coffee. And I remember going in there for the first time. And I think I went in there because I saw someone else I knew had like mentioned it on Instagram or something. And I went in there and they had this, I wasn't a vegan at the time. I'm a vegan now, but this almost 10 years ago, definitely not a vegan then. They had this, what they called the vegan munchies burrito. And it was like a breakfast burrito, but it was vegan. And I swear to this day, it's still the best vegan breakfast burrito I've ever had. I would actually put it up there with any breakfast burrito, arguably vegan or not. It's just amazing. Throw a little sriracha on there and it's a really good way to start the day. But I remember I went there, I got a cup of coffee. I went down to the beach and sat on the beach and I was hooked on that spot and kind of that routine every time I would come back. I love people that create, that take things that match neighborhoods and take history and lineage and then combine it with something new. And that's what they did with this Dogtown. If you don't know a lot about Dogtown, Dogtown is kind of, not the expert on this, but we'll dig into it a little bit. But it's kind of like the lineage of like skateboarding and surfing culture in Venice Beach, Santa Monica. And the owners took this idea and have plugged it in and kind of rebrought it back as a coffee shop, as realty. And I think they do a really great job. So we're going to sit down with the owner. You're going to meet the owner today. He's an entrepreneur. He owns Dogtown Realty. He owns Dogtown Coffee. He is a former, I was in the military in Israel, and he had a dream to move to Venice Beach, which was inspired by The Real World season 2, which I love. I love hearing about people that have dreams that actually live into them. Like how many people wanted, we saw something when we were young that we wanted to do and we didn't do it. Well, he did. And he met his wife. She was a barista and he hit on her. And I love that. And he like went after what he wanted and he got what he wanted there. He was reborn. He says he was like reborn at Burning Man. Some cool stuff I want to talk about. He's working on a book. And then he's probably done what most of us are afraid to do. He's had over $100,000 in debt and he's lost everything multiple times. There's so much juicy stuff here to talk about. Asaf Raz, did I say it right?
You said it perfect.
Oh my God. Got it.
You knocked it.
Thanks, man. Welcome to the Dream Mason podcast.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
How are you?
Doing great, my friend.
Well, thanks for being here. Thanks for, like I said, you created something really cool and really fun. And I think sometimes it's like the simplest things, right? Like it's, you didn't change gravity or put but you created something that like impacted. So and I know that if it impacted me, it impacts other people. But it like, for me, like I said, it marked a place like home and gave it, like I told you before we started, I had to have a Dogtown coffee mug that I took back to New York. So I would feel like I was kind of at home when I would drink my coffee in the morning. Just give me a little bit, like what inspired you to create, you know, you're not from Venice, you're not from Santa Monica. What has you come here from Israel to Southern California and kind of take the lineage of surfing and skating culture and make a realty brand and a coffee shop out of it?
All right. So I'll do my best to unpack it in an order that would make sense. And you tell me where you would like me to expand. I tend to speak in the more bullet points.
Go for it.
But tracing back for a second. So the summary of it would be that, yes, as a kid, I fell in love with United States of America, and not for the glittering stuff and the splashy and the fast cars and all this. I never actually cared for any of that. The idea of United States of America, it's becoming, its role in the world, its ups and downs. I was vastly attracted to this country. And growing up in Israel, you look at America as your big brother, as your father, I'm quoting actually from this show, Homeland. In one of the season, it's explained in a very vivid way, the relationship between Israel and America. But loved America as a young kid. Really want to move in. I actually came to Venice Beach, California the first time when I was 16 years old. I convinced my dad to somehow send me over there. I want to see the American life, to do high school in America. He agreed, sent me over. It was a debacle. It did not work from various reasons. I went back home, finished high school, went to the military, finished the military. And 5 days afterward, I went to America. Now, at that time, I already knew I'm going to Venice because, as I mentioned in the writing, I loved MTV, the origins of them. I'm a Generation X. So I saw MTV rises. And yes, I did. My entire acquaintance with Venice was through The Real World, the second season, watching Venice and all these cool people in that house by the water, this rundown place, and all these fun, weird people. And I start tracking the whole thing about Venice Beach, California. I even had a webcam trained on the boardwalk while I was in the last year in the military. That's when webcams start coming about. And I every time when I come back from the military, I would look at the webcam and see people on the boardwalk. So yes, when the military was over, I came to Venice. We scrapped whatever money, a little bit of money we had, me and a bunch of folks from my, I grew up in a small town. So a bunch of us from my small town, we came over and we came to Venice like December 7th, 98. I remember it was Pearl Harbor Day, 98. And we were amazed. I mean, we came from like a small town, never smoked pot in my life, never, barely any got drunk. And suddenly we're in Venice Beach, California, where everything is possible. So those first few years were quite crazy, to say the least. Loved the neighborhood. I was the kind of, it took me actually 17 years to see the Hollywood sign, just to put things in perspective.
Yeah, people don't
really care.
People don't know. Like, I mean, you, I love that you just said that. People don't necessarily realize, like, if you live on the west side, you often don't go east of the 405. And if you live on the
405, I didn't cross Lincoln.
Right. If you live like over in Hollywood, a lot of times people don't come, you know, maybe to the beach sometimes, but like there is you know, Lincoln, the 405, there's like almost this clear divide between the west side and the east side of LA. And it's not like a rivalry. People just don't go. They stay kind of on their side.
Yeah. So, you know, as you know, because you're born and raised, I was considered an AWOL, always west of Lincoln. And I built a whole life west of Lincoln Boulevard, a whole life since the beginning till now.
Yeah, I'm sure. And, I want to say, I'm sure at that point you were single, right? And like,
totally single, yeah.
And you meet somebody in LA and they tell you they live like on the other side and you're like, this isn't going to work out.
Listen, just because you brought it up,
yeah,
I was the kind of guy that when I was a bachelor, and if my wife hears this podcast, she would kill me. But the point was, I was the kind of guy who acted like the girl, being that I never drove anywhere. Frankly, many times I didn't even have a car. Mm-hmm. I would bring the dates to Venice, always. but anyway, so did all those years and I became a surfer in Venice. And I never surfed in Israel, but I became a surfer in Venice. And to start tying with the Dogtown thing, I started getting acquainted with Dogtown here, Dogtown there in the water. I didn't actually understand what Dogtown was, to be fair. I thought it was this cool underground vibe. I kind of liked seeing the crosses with the Dogtown and everything, but I wasn't actually paying any attention, which many times the lesson in life is don't let the obvious escape you, which one of my old mentors told me that. And then circa... I think the movie came out. I don't recall the year of the movie. It must be like 2009 or 10. At one point, the documentary comes out, Dogtown and the Z-Boys. I don't recall the exact year, but it's a few years prior to the opening. And I watched the documentary and I was stunned. And I was absolutely stunned by what I've seen in the documentary. I found myself like almost like, I'm surfing those spots. I'm around the people. And I didn't know all this time about that rich history of surf and skate and all these things that happened during the 70s, during those few years. And then after that, when I saw that thing, at that point I was already a real estate broker. And I went and I bought the domain name for Dogtown Realty. Now my broker, I worked for another broker, and he asked me, why are you doing that? You work in Venice Properties. I work in the coolest boutique agency in Venice ever. It was called Venice Properties. My mentor, Jack Hoffman, a dear, dear friend and mentor, loved the guy. And he was stunned. Why are you buying this name? And I said to him, listen, I saw this documentary. It's amazing. It's happening underneath our feet. I don't know. I have a feeling that maybe, just maybe one day that name will make a sense to me. So I'm buying it right now and I'm switching my email address from raz@venisproperties.com to raz@dogtownrealty.com. He's like, fine, do it. So I did it, bought the name. And then later on the road, and that's the theme of the story, is constantly don't let the obvious escape you. At one point or another, I was entrusted to start handling the family that owned the Dogtown building. Now, I didn't connect it to the same building. That's how foolish I was. Even though I watched the documentary, even though I bought the domain, I did not piece one and one that it's the exact same. I mean, it's so ridiculous that, you know, the surf shop that was there, Horizon West, the legendary surf shop that opened after the Zephyr shop, Randy Wright, he was the owner. I bought my first surfboards from Randy And I didn't connect all the dots.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I was started getting involved in the project about this building, not really aware that it's the same building of the history. And fast forward a little bit further, the family that owned the building, they wanted to demolish it and turn this big condo project. And I was their real estate advisor. And I gave them the advice of not doing it. And I had my reasoning of why not to do this. And at one point or another, they actually decided to listen, like, fine, we're not going to do it. And then they told me, sell the building. Now, I managed to get them an offer from one of my clients within 24 hours. Now, I was due to make a commission of about, I don't know, $300,000. Big number, big chunk of money. And at that point in life, unrelated to everything I just said, me and my two upcoming partners in Dogtown Coffee, because we're three of us own it equally, we were looking to make some sort of a Mediterranean place in Venice, a pet project. What do we know about food? None of us knew anything about food. And I said, fine, let's open a hummus place. It'll be fun. We'll do a project in Venice. And then I'm going to meet the buyer. So it's, all these things are happening in a parallel, overlapping each other. And while the family is thinking about the offer, my clients, I meet with the buyer, who was also my client, and we're standing on a mid-afternoon day looking at the building. The building was a shambles. I mean, it was ghetto building. It was also North Main at that point was really bad. And he says to me, Asaf, if you had any say about this building, what would you do with it? Specifically, he asked me, what would you do with the corner? And only then, only that moment, by divine intervention, because I am a religious kind of guy. I love my God. I love God, Elohim in Hebrew. I felt the light. I saw this vision. I start mumbling. I told him, well, I don't know. You open a coffee shop, caters to the history. This is the Dogtown building after. I mean, I was literally connecting the dots live with the would-be buyer of the building. And he's like nodding his head, says, oh, interesting. And I'm hitting myself in the head. I'm like, oh my God, what am I saying here? So I rushed home after the meeting and I woke up my brother. I said for him, forget about the hummus place. Forget about all this nonsense. We need to open this cafe, Dogtown Cafe. At that point, I the name that I had in mind was Dogtown Cafe. One of my other partners eventually changed it to Dogtown Coffee. And this is the idea, blah, 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 blah. We're going to cater for the history. We're going to bring it back. We're going to do something for the community. We only have one little problem. And he's like, what? I'm about to sell the building and make a hell of a lot of commission. He's like, then what can we do? I said, well, we pray for God. We pray to God that the deal will fall through. I've never in my life prayed not to receive $300,000. Never. And that was the night. I prayed. I said, God, please cancel the deal. If you can. Not by my own doing. But if it meant to be, cancel the deal. The following morning, the owner of the building calls me, says the following, listen, Asaf, I hope you're not going to kill us, but since this building is quite sentimental for us, because the whole family legacy began there, which is a whole story on its own. It's a great, great family with roots, and they bought the building in the beginning of the century. And he says to me, Asaf, please don't be upset, but we decided not to sell. And if you don't mind, if you're willing to stay on the job with us, if you can propose what to do with the building, we would appreciate if you stay. So I muted this. I had this internal scream of joy. And I said to him, well, since you're asking. And that was the beginning of the road for the opening of the coffee shop. So that's kind of like their real estate company, funny enough, which was already in existence prior to that, received its own home in the building, which, by the way, I don't have anymore. I gave the keys for that office for different reason about 2 years ago. Decided to be a little bit more agile with my financial movements. But for 5 years, we actually had the real estate office there too. And that was one hell of a closing a circle from the day I bought the domain to ultimately open a brokerage within the Dogtown building. So a lot of serendipitous moments. Don't let the obvious escape you. Luck, preparedness, and willing to jump.
I want to ask you about like that willingness to jump, that doing, like you guys were not coffee shop people, cafe people, you know, you said you're real estate. When you started, I told you I came from the restaurant business And like, it's a messy world. Coffee shop isn't as big, but you do have food there. You're serving food, you're serving drinks. What were some of those big challenges you ran into when you got started? Like, oh, now we're in the hospitality business or in the coffee shop business.
Fair question. And I've had the pleasure of helping quite a few entrepreneurs in the last 9 years that reached out to us with the same exact question from different reasons, but they're always asking us, what are the pitfalls to avoid? Now, here's the thing. The three of us, our combined knowledge about food was the fact that back in 1999, I was a barista in Starbucks for a year and a half. That was it. One partner is a lawyer. The other one was a successful salesperson for skincare products. And I sold buildings. Yeah. Not a single ounce of knowledge about food and drink. Now, so the biggest, so to answer your question, the biggest problem that we faced was lack of knowledge and the fact that we so-called save costs where we shouldn't have, which vis-a-vis advisors. We just jumped into the deep water with no advisors. We used a stupid Excel. I swear to God, we did an Excel to predict what's going to happen to us. It was the dumbest Excel ever. I still have it for this. I mean, we predicted that we're going to sell 25 cups of coffee a day. I'm sorry, 75 cups of coffee a day and 25 pieces of food. And this is how we organize ourselves. And which led to ultimately for us almost collapsing within the first 24 hours. We were so wrong. But to answer your question, we jumped in with no knowledge, no advisors, and complete inability to know your cost. And as you know, since you have vastly more experience than me, not knowing your cost of goods sold is the difference between dying and living. That's one of the reasons that when you walk in the street, if you understand restaurant, when you walk in the street, when you see a restaurant full of people and you're like, oh my God, they're printing money. No, it's not true at all. You might see them a month later with a closed door because they don't know how much a potato cost them and how much to price it when they're making French fries. And we had to learn it the hard way. And we were beaten to pulp. The only thing that saved us was this unbelievable local support. They filled the breach, and the breach was big and deep. But we were saved from our inexperience by the fact that people helped us. So in a sense, today when people come to me and ask me, what do I need to know in order to open a restaurant? Which, by the way, we are actually by now our bona fide restaurant. We also got our beer and wine license 2 weeks ago. But I always tell them, if you don't know what you're doing, then you better hire people that do know, who can help you, hold your hand, digest the food, give you proper prediction. You need to know your inventory. You need to know this business, because not like real estate or other businesses that it's intangible transfer of products where I don't have to worry that the shelf life of the condo that I'm selling. I don't even hold it. Somebody else is holding it, it's paying its bills. I'm just helping the title to transfer. When you step into the food business with these perishable and small margins, if you don't know what you're doing, you can be decimated within seconds. Our story is a different one, but we were not saved due to our own skills as much as the fact that the neighborhood decided to save us. And they did it again during Corona, which is a whole different story. But the neighborhood, we owe them everything. And you are an amazing staff.
You speak, I mean, it's reminding me as you're talking about this, like it's not just the restaurant business. I think there's a lot of, you know, I would love to have a boat. It's not the boat that's expensive, right? It's the upkeep of the boat. It's the where you keep the boat. You know, it's really nice to have like an Audi or a BMW or a Mercedes, and a lot of us can afford those. And when the warranty's up, the upkeep becomes more expensive. It's not the car, right? It's these other things. And I think the restaurant business is very similar to that. Whereas like, look, anybody can go become a real estate agent. And like you, if you're not good, you're not going to sell houses, right? Like clearly you knew what you were doing. You're good at it. But while anyone can also open a restaurant, to your point, it's like a, opening a restaurant is like doing a Spartan race, but you think it's going to be all like sexy and you're going to look all good, but really you're going to be getting hit by, you know, sandbags over and over again. And I love how you describe that as it's true. People think restaurants, you know, and bars are these sexy businesses and they're so fun and they have great ideas. And unfortunately, yeah, if you don't know what a tomato costs, then you don't know what that sandwich costs and you don't know what to charge and you don't realize all the behind the scenes bills you have to pay. Having a full restaurant doesn't mean you have any money.
That's correct.
It's a really great point. And unfortunately, you had to learn it the hard way. But the cool thing is you're still standing, which has me come around to the thing that I shared when we started. Most people are so terrified to lose something. To fail, to lose, to take a risk, and maybe it doesn't work. Most people play life very safe, right? Work the same job, you know, date people that they're comfortable with, you know, live in the same place they've lived or the place they move that they feel comfortable. Most people are not really willing to gamble or go big and play for what they really want. But when I read about you and it's like, hey, you've lost everything three times in life, you've been hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. The thing that I thought immediately was like, man, so he plays big, he takes risks, because you wouldn't lose everything and have all this debt if you didn't take risks or play it safe. Can you speak a little to that? Like the risks?
Of course. And I'll give you, like the way I speak, I'll give you a skeleton. And if you want me to expand, I'll expand.
Sure. Yeah.
So first of all, to go to the roots of it, when I was like a really young kid, and I'm always a kid, but like when my body was younger, I had this notion in my mind that life is like a movie and I'm the director and I am the actor and I am the crowd. And I made this pact with myself that my life must become a movie worth watching when I'm darn old, on a swing, enjoying the sun. And all I have is my memories of what happened. It's better be a good movie. I really want to remember a good movie. Now, the caveat, when I say good, I don't mean no pain and anguish and tragedy. I mean a good movie. Good movie has act one, two, three, and the rest. So from a young age, I viewed that life must be that movie that I want to watch. That's something that led me through my entire life. Now, so going into losing everything, obviously, if I had that type of a mantra, it meant that whether I was right or wrong, many times in my life, I jump in and I jump in for the sake of the experience. And my first, I guess my first collapse, which taught me a lot, was in my early 20s when I got into real estate with family, and I was 22 years old. I was barely fresh off the boat. So I was new in America, and my family, to be precise, my dad, wanted me to diversify from just being a DJ, doing drugs and having fun, into be more sensible and be responsible for other stuff. So let me kind of help you to go into real estate. And I bought my first home in Venice when I was 22, 23. Back then, believe it or not, houses were like, I bought my house for like $240,000. Dirt in Venice now is 1.5. And I bought that land with my dad's help for $240,000. Now, the great mistake that I've made, which I didn't know that time, is that money that is not yours and you have not earned and you never earned it, you don't get much say on it, even if you think you do. And if you have not earned it, you don't know what it means to use it properly. And my greatest mistake then was that I fell into it. And I blame myself. I don't blame my dad. I blame myself. And when eventually I discovered that his gift has turned into a loan, and you can read between the lines, I looked at myself. I remember that day. It was somewhere in my late 20s there. I was doing buying and selling, and I was moving the money, actually. I was moving it very good. It was growing. But then the due date came. And I suddenly realized that everything I worked for, he's going to take. And I'm going to be left with all the taxes and all the bills. And I don't blame him. My fault. My complete fault for falling into it. But what happened was that I looked at my bank. I'll never forget. I looked at my bank account and I had hundreds of thousands of dollars in that account. And I said to myself, wow, I can move forward. Somebody offered me this real estate, big real estate deal that I can move the money into it. And I knew that everything's going to evaporate the next day. And all I'm going to be left with is what I owe the IRS for all the success. And I got crushed to the ground. I got crushed to the ground. I owed all in with everything. Maybe I was left with about $150,000 in debt that one time. And rebuilding myself from that point, that was my first crush, has taught me that never again do I ever want to be in the mercy of another person's money. Now, I don't mind you to invest with me under terms, conditions, whatever, but don't be doing me no favors. Whether you're my dad or a friend, I don't want favors. I want it to be legit. I want you to eat food with, and I want it to be clear. And it was a valuable lesson. And the second lesson that came out of it was to be detached, because there were parts of me that, as one friend told me, he's like, don't send him the money. Don't send him back the money. He lied to you. He told you it's a gift. Now it turned into a loan. Don't send the money back. But that was reprehensible for me to consider. It was my father. Doesn't matter, he changed his mind. The point is, that was never my money. Doesn't matter that I grew it. Doesn't matter that I fought hard for it to make it grow. You give it back. You give it back so I know that everything that I stand on, I earned. It was a hard lesson, but it taught me to be detached from collapse. Because after that one, I didn't care being poor to be broke. Poor is a state of mind. I didn't care being broke after that. Like, fine, let's experience what it is to be broke when you get all those creditor letters. And by the way, as a side comment, in all my life in America, with as bad as I was, I never missed a payment. I have like a credit score of like 849, like seniors. Never missed a payment in my life. So that's the reason I never accept the excuse of not paying your bills because it was hard for you. It's bullshit. Excuse my French. You can pay your bills. You have to look hard and make sure that you own it, because I have a bill, it's a contract. It's your word of honor. So he taught me a lot, but I won't lie to you. I was in pain. That was just the first collapse.
What happened with your relationship with your dad in that moment?
Like, that's a great question. I'm happy to say that in years, and especially in the last years, it's evolved back into a good friendship. But unfortunately, and I say that sadly, there's this bond. I'm a father. I have two kids. And there's this thing that when you look at your kids, you want them to know that no matter what in life, no matter what you do, no matter who you are, no matter what happened, I'm always going to be there. I'm always going to be there. You need me middle of the night, I'm always going to be there. You need me to do, I'm always going to be there. There's no other option for me. Unfortunately for me, and I don't look bad on myself, and nobody should ever pity me, because maybe it's making me a better dad for my own kid. Unfortunately, I lost that bond with my dad. And even though I love him, and even though I'll be there for him, and we're good friends now, unfortunately, I don't trust him. And I wouldn't call him in the middle of the night if I was in danger. I would never call my dad. And it saddens me to say it. And I love the guy, and he's a good guy, and he means well. And what he did, it's his own doing. I don't judge him. But that sacred bond of a son to a father, that you know that your father will be there for, I don't have it. And nobody should feel sorry for me. I believe it makes me a better father to my own son. So we're good friends now. We're just, there's boundaries.
I love that. I love that lesson, because I talk about this with my clients a lot. You know, as a parent, you can do everything perfect, whatever perfect is, right? You could be the best dad, the best parent, whatever that means, because I don't know what that means. But let's just say you could do it that way. Your kids will still have their issues, right? No child grows up like almost like a perfectly clean slate. The way I've been describing it recently is, if you've ever drank a smoothie out of a clean glass, children are clean glasses. And life is like, once you put that smoothie in, no matter, once you drink it all out, the sides are coated, it's crusty, it's not clear anymore. And that's just what life does to us, whether, you know, because our parents can't be perfect, our grandparents can't be perfect, our society can't be perfect, and it leaves a coating on us. But I do believe from a spiritual place that the coating that gets left on us is what enables us to become the people we need to be. So the coating that your dad left on you, and you said it, I'm just saying it a different way, maybe is so you can be the dad that you need to be, or you can be the man you need to be, right? And maybe had he not done the things that he did, or you not done the things that you did, and the relationship was different, you wouldn't be able to be who you really needed to be in the world, maybe for your kids, maybe for yourself. The other thing I was thinking is funny. I was like, man, I have that bond with my parents. Like, I know my parents have my back. Me and my dad have an interesting relationship, but I know my parents have my back, both of them. And I was like, as long as I don't call them during dinner, because if I call them during dinner, they're not available. But if I call them at any other time, they're available. But I like how you break it up into, it's not an all or nothing, right? We all have problems with our parents in different ways. And a lot of us make it like, oh, I can't talk to them. And what I hear you did, which is sounds really empowering and very cool, is, hey, I love him. He's my friend. And he's not the person that I would call in the middle of the night if I got into a jam. He can be both at the same time. It's not like it has to be one or the other.
That is correct.
Thanks for sharing that. I didn't know that we were going to go there, but I really appreciate that. I want to talk to you because you are an entrepreneur. You have multiple businesses. You have kids. Are you still married?
I'm still with your God wife. Bless. My wife is, she's my queen. Oh, absolutely. Love the woman.
I want to ask you, I always like when people come on and they're successful in business, they're clearly, you know, like it's important to be a good parent to them. I have a lot of people that come on here and share these views. I like to ask them about their relationships and like how it works and what empowers it. And what are the things that have, you know, everybody wants to be, most people want to be in relationships and most people would love to be in empowered, loving relationships. So I like to hear different people's takes on, hey, what makes your relationship work? What do you guys practice? What do you do? Any tips or secrets that you would share?
That's a great question. I met my wife, and a little bit of correction about the beginning of the podcast when you gave some of the pretext about my life. I was actually the barista, not her. In other words, when we opened the coffee shop, in the first 10 days that we opened, she wasn't my wife then, obviously, but Shannon came into the coffee shop as a patron. And the story, if I can plug it in for a second, when I was 16, I had a dream, a vivid dream. And I saw the face of the woman that I would one time in my life I'm destined to meet. And in years after that, I somewhat chucked away that thing away. And then I got married, got divorced after 8 years. And then when we opened the coffee shop, Shannon came in. I knew that's the woman from my dream. So, and then I hit on her. So I was the barista, not her. She was the patron. And Shannon and I, from the moment that I asked her out, which she blew me off for about 5 minutes, we never left each other's side besides quick business trips, whatever, but very much with each other. And there's a few foundations that make our relationship extremely good. And once again, my definition of good does not exclude tough moments. First and foremost, we're very similar. We have the same birthday. We're two rebels. I mean, I'm 7 years older, but we have the same date. And we're both rebels and we both love freedom. I'm very much consider myself a libertarian. And my wife, even though she did not understand those concepts in time, she grew to view herself as a libertarian very much. And freedom is super important for us. And it means that you give absolute trust to each other. You choose to give trust You don't need proofs. You bank it. Once again, jumping into the deep water. We both jump into the deep water. I gave her the keys for my place after 48 hours of being with her. I'm like, hey, take the key. We're going to get married. It's okay. Have the key. And the idea behind what we did is this full transparency with each other, that everything is an open book. There's nothing to hide. If you want to ask, ask. Maybe some questions don't ask. Maybe you're not going to like the answer. But, and she didn't like some of my answers. Maybe I didn't like some of her answers. But the point is, my wife and I live on this system of complete authenticity where we speak our minds, we speak our heart. We learned how to debate, which I credit her for that. She, when she met me, she said to me, Asaf, I don't understand you. Now, for me, it was aggravating to hear because what you mean she don't understand? And I know I have an accent, but I tend to be coherent and I'm logical in the way I build my points. But when she said that to me, and that was post-rebirth, that what happened to me in Burning Man, about a year after my rebirth. And my rebirth was a part of a dark journey after my divorce, very dark journey. And then I realized that, you know what? To myself, I said to myself, I kind of remember other women in my life saying that they don't understand me. So maybe if I don't want to get divorced again, a second time, how about I listen to her? So I asked her, what do you want to do? She's like, I want to bring a communication advisor to our home. Now we only dated for a few months. And that communication advisor was like, I don't know, $2,500, best $2,500 I ever invested. I was like, fine, bring him. Let's talk. That was a monumental moment. This guy came, amazing guy, Bill Sterl. He used the nonviolent communication method by Professor or Dr. Marshall Rosenberg, who I knew, I read his book before that. And he worked with us for about for a few months. Weekly meetings, strictly dealing with how do you communicate. He said to us from the first meeting, I'm going to give you tools that if you're going to use them, I promise you, you're going to be able to diffuse all issues, most issues, of course, some issues are beyond diffusing. Mm-hmm. As long as you use the tool, you have to choose to use the tool, which is a very good point about staying present in life. All the training in the world won't help you if in the moment you let the ego take over and you don't use the present moment. Mm-hmm. And he gave us those tools. And Shannon and I were able to use these tools through our entire, we've been married for almost 9 years with two beautiful kids. And Shannon and I come from vastly different cultures, vastly different. And we were able to gap those two worlds, to bridge them, to make something new. Due to the fact that we first and foremost are committed to open dialogue, no matter what we say. So in my house, there's no such thing as safe space. The word offensive speech and all this thing, I'm sorry, I don't believe in that. Speech is meant to irk you many times. If you want to grow, you have to be able to withstand things you hate hearing, unless you want to get divorced again. And we were able to foster the type of communication. I'm proud of her because she's a builder. Once she's in a relationship, she want to build. This is her nest. You don't mess with her. She's a lioness. And she was right. And she led the charge in building the type of communication that is the pillar of our relationship. So in context, I will make the context that it's like having a constitution. We don't have to agree on things. But if the two sides agree that the Constitution governs, then there is hope because you would use a framework that both sides agree, even if the issue is like supercharged. Like, for example, vaccination. My wife and I are completely different aisles on vaccination. When it came to the circumcision of our son, because we're a Jewish family, my wife and I were in extremely different aisles. It's tough. How do you go through such tough moments? If you have this type of communication, you have a chance. So the best advice I can always give to people is twofold. One, everything I just said, which is basically communication. Second, you better remember why you wanted to marry her in the first place and keep it up. Because if you don't remember the joy of seeing her the first time you ever saw her, when I will never forget seeing her in the restaurant and her sparkling eyes. I always keep it in front of me because it's the same girl. If you forget it's that girl, you're due for some pain. So I always keep up that this is the girl I dreamt about. And it's helpful.
Wait,
those are the two things. I answered your question.
Yeah, you did. I have two quick follow-ups. One is, what's the book and what was the guy that you worked with? What were those names?
So the book is, if I recall correctly, it's called Nonviolent Communication by Professor or Dr. Marshall Rosenberg. It's a system, it's a method that, unbelievable method, what he devised. Now, that's one thing. The guy, his name is Bill Sterl. Maybe I'm mispronouncing his last name. I have his information. I'll gladly plug it in if you want it. But he was the communication advisor who came to our house. And I love the guy. And one thing I love the most about him, he was not politically correct. He told me, I'll share with you one thing. My pet peeve is about dishes in the sink. I can't stand seeing dishes in the sink. My dad raised me. I was raised in a military home. My dad was a colonel. There's no such thing as leaving dishes in the sink. If you leave dishes in the sink, that means that you think you have a slave somewhere all around the house, a butler. There are no butlers. You will wake me up at 4 a.m. if I left one cup.
Yeah.
Come and clean it. Your dad's not supposed to clean it at 4 a.m. when he gets back from the military. And when Bill started working with us, and Shannon, well, let's just say Shannon loves keeping dishes no matter what. Bill looked at me and he said, listen, Asaf, she will never, more than likely, be 100% on dishes. In other words, get ready for it, Asaf. There will always be dishes in the sink. You have to learn how to live with it. You have to take it the way it is. And I was like, okay. So he's that kind of guy to speak like straight to you.
Just straight talk.
Love the guy.
Okay, this is my last question. Then we're going to wrap up. But you said, you talked about how you had a dream about the woman you were going to marry. But then you also shared you were married before. So you clearly, I don't know, fell in love or something before and got married. But I want to say, like, it sounds like you didn't listen to your instincts or your internal knowing. Where was the disconnect that had you have a vision of a woman you were going to marry, but then marry a different woman?
So I'll answer it and I'll tie in the rebirth moment.
Please.
In a nutshell. So yes, the dream was when I was 16 years old. I remembered it vividly. And what happens in life is many times with a dream that you get, an actual dream during the night, is that you doubt its existence. And it was very profound, but when I reconciled life versus it, I chose life and pushed the dream away because it was too fantastical to even believe in it. And therefore, in your word, and you're quite correct, even though I kept that dream always kind of like in the back end of my mind and my heart, I chose to push it away as, like, I don't know, like reading Lords of the Ring when I was 12. So when I met my ex-wife and been with her for 8 years, I always kind of in the back of my mind, I heard that voice, hey, you know, it's not the girl from the dream. It's not the girl from the dream. I'm like, ah, whatever, doesn't matter. When I got divorced and I went through hell on earth with full drugs, darkness, alcohol, the whole nine yards. And when I was in Burning Man, like the climax of my dark journey, 7 days of drugs in Burning Man, when I nearly OD'd, I had a moment in an epiphany in the temple. People that go to Burning Man, they know about the temple out there. When I was literally, my psyche was between losing it or keeping it. And I heard the voice of that woman saying, I'm still coming. And when I was 32 years old, I remember that when I was 16, I heard her. I guess I had to go through all of this in order to be willing to listen. And that when I made the vow that I don't care what happens next, I will not rest until I found that exact woman, not a type of a woman, that woman. And I did. And so, I will say that the journey to find her was just as good as finding her, to be honest.
Yeah. It's amazing. I have I share this with people that are single clients, people that reach out to me. if you want, you can look at the journey to finding your partner as getting you ready for your partner. That the reason you haven't found your person yet, whoever it is, right? I don't mean to say it like there's one, but you're not ready for them. You'll fuck it up, for lack of a better word. That the journey that we're on is actually preparing us and them too, so that when we actually meet, it can work. And that a lot of people get really bummed out. You know, I've tried all these things. I've done all these things. I can't meet the person. I blah, blah, blah. And it's like, you're not ready yet. And now, and when you are ready, it will happen. Or you need to do, or maybe you're not taking the right actions to get ready. But,
amen.
You know,
amen, my friend. There's actually a scene. I used to watch How I Met Your Mother during the dark times to remind myself that one day maybe I'll find somebody. And there's a beautiful scene in that show where this woman is telling a story in the car for Ted. He was the main guy. And she's telling a story about how she drove fast and a cop caught her. And he's like, young lady, I've been waiting all day for you to show up. And she looks at the cop and she answers, officer, I came here as fast as I could. And the lessons from that is like, you know, your woman or your man, whatever.
Yeah.
They're coming to you as fast as they can. And it's kind of complement what you said. That you have to believe that they are coming to you, whatever it is, a woman, life, your book, your thing, they're coming as fast as they can, but you kind of have a role in it.
Yeah. There's a song, I don't know who sings it, but it talks about how all the detours that we hit actually lead us to where we need to go. So all the people that you dated, all the people that you hooked up with, all the people that you met that didn't like you, you know, that you flirted with and said no, every one of them was a detour to get you where you needed to be. And now look, you can just like in a car, there can be a sign that says road closed and you can drive through the sign. Now there's going to be some consequences, which I think is what happens to many of us on our journey, is there's detours and we ignore them. We ignore the stop signs. We ignore the yellow lights, the green lights, the warning, the lanes merging. We ignore all these metaphorical signs. And so we get in trouble, but that like life, I want to say like life has a way. Yeah. I don't remember. If you remember Jurassic Park, they always say life has a way, right? Life has a way.
Great line.
And it does, because look, the world keeps going, whether humans participate or not, right? The flowers grow, the trees grow, there's animals. You know, we often mess up the mother nature and the earth, but it has a way of working without any human interaction. You know, we think we're a lot more powerful than we are.
Amen.
I want to thank you for being here with me. I don't know if you realize how deep we might go into your relationship with your dad. But I just want to acknowledge you and thank you for being here. Thanks for being vulnerable. Thanks for sharing your journey and your story, for coming from heart, for having a wife that you put on a pedestal, some children that you really care about, and also just like living a life full of passion. I'm really present. Like you're doing all these cool things because you live life from passion. And you said earlier, I jump right in. So thanks for being an example for other people. So if I believe that if someone can do it, then anyone can. So thanks for being that.
I appreciate it. Thank you as well for the opportunity to speak with you. I agree. Thank you.
Everyone listening, thanks for being here. I know you got something from this episode. If you didn't, listen to it again or pay better attention. Please, who do you know that needs to hear this episode? Who's trying to start a business and scared? Who's going through a tough relationship? Who has lost it all? Who might be losing it all? But who do you know that needs to hear something in this episode? Please share it with them. And thanks for being here. Appreciate you. There's no show with no listeners. There's just two people having a conversation. So I appreciate you. Thank you. And we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening. Honestly, I'm just a rebel who found a cause and has a dream, and I'm super grateful for your support. If you got anything from this, please help me out and share this podcast with one person today. You can find me at thedreammason.com or at inspirationalalex on Instagram. You are a dream mason because your dreams don't build themselves.